You are listening to the In Civitis podcast. Can you put like an echo on that or something, or like something explosive?
Echoes and lasers. Pew, 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 pew. All right. Hello. This is Nick Civitis. You just heard Gregory Kallenberg, the executive director of the Louisiana Film Prize. This episode is brought to you by the Louisiana Film Prize, a short film festival in Shreveport, Louisiana. The winner of that festival wins $50,000 in cash. It's quite the festival experience. You'll hear more about that later in the show. For those of you who stick around all the way to the end, you might just hear a special discount to get 50% off your submission fees for the festival. Before we go further, I do want to say we will not have lasers and explosion sound effects on the show. Apologies, Gregory. We do have something special, though, something even better, I would say, than explosions and lasers, in my humble opinion. Our guest today is Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist and writer Rick Bragg. He's written for the New York Times. He writes a column for Southern Living, and he has a couple of really fantastic books that he's also put together. Most recently, he's come out with a book, a biography on the rock and roll legend Jerry Lee Lewis, based on extensive interviews that he did with him and people who knew him. It's a terrific book. This is going to be a little different than other interviews that you may have heard with writers. The focus here is the art of collaboration, on doing things well with others. So I talked to Rick a little bit about how he works with his subjects to get a story across, about making his subjects feel comfortable so that they can share some difficult things that come up. Plus, Rick is one of those rare writers who has a kind of rock star charisma when he is discussing his work with others. It's quite the spectacle, worth seeing him live if you can for that kind of interaction. We talk a little bit about that. And we also discuss some of the themes in his books, because I believe the Jerry Lee Lewis book is actually a culmination of a lot of the themes that we've seen in his prior work. So we talk about that, and then afterwards I'll try to tie it all in. There's a lot to take in here. It's quite the conversation. Get comfortable, get relaxed, get ready. The interview with Rick Bragg coming up next.
This is the In Civitis podcast.
Hello, hello, hello. Welcome to the In Civitis podcast, Rick Bragg.
Thank you.
This is a show that looks at the art of collaboration. And one of the things that's striking about your stories is the sense of community that you bring to them. So how do you go about doing that?
I think one is, if you grow up in it, which, you know, the books that I did on the people, the foothills of the Appalachians, you know the scenery. And I don't mean just the landscape. You know what a canned jar of crabapple jelly looks like in a windowsill. You know the accents and the vernacular. You know that if someone builds a redwood deck on their mobile home, you don't make fun of that. That is someone proud of what they have. You know that acres and acres and acres of pine trees are not necessarily a thing of beauty because they've been put there because all the old growth timber has been clear cut. So, you know, those descriptions help form a backdrop, just like they would on a stage for the events. And if you don't know it, you have to learn it.
I'm also taken by the way that you capture people's insecurities and their fears. A lot of the things that would probably take some time to have someone else share with you. So how do you establish that kind of trust with the people you interview?
Well, that's a pretty good question. In my most recent book on rock and roll singer Jerry Lee Lewis, I had to be pretty upfront and tell him that we would have to talk about everything hard. We would have to talk about debt. We'd have to talk about drug addiction. We'd have to talk about decline. We'd have to talk about heaven and hell.
And you told him that right from the beginning?
Right. We had to, because there's really no point in the book, no point at all, if he's not willing to talk to me and to talk honestly about, his marriage to his 13-year-old cousin, his fall from grace in England, his, comeback, which has been, I guess, going on for 60 years. You know, I did the interview sitting next to his bedside. So I said the first or second day, we're going to have to talk about awful things. We're going to have to talk about the deaths of your sons. We're going to have to talk about loss in pretty much every form. If you live life like Jerry Lee Lewis, you play catch with a bunch of broken glass. And, yeah, you just have to say that up front. And to his credit, he bore up to it. I guess if you're Jerry Lee Lewis talking about a life that nearly as hard as living one, that wasn't any big deal for him. And he was, I think, brutally honest most of the time. And another thing, too, is a lot of it, I hate to say it, but a lot of it really is mood. If you kind of have to surf those moods in the interviews and know when the time is right to push and when the time is right to just yuck it up a little bit. You know, that might not sound like a very scientific way of interviewing, but sometimes you wait till the next day. Sometimes you hope you can get out of the room without getting shot. I'm not kidding.
Well, you know, speaking of yucking it up, I was really taken by the way that you engaged the audience at the Louisiana Book Festival when I first heard you speak. It's not a skill that a lot of writers can do. Some people are good at telling stories, but you were also very compelling in the way that you interacted with others. So was that something you were always good at, or did you learn that as a journalist?
Well, I think as a journalist, you learn that, you know, interaction is so much better than any kind of static interview process where you just pick at people. Talking with people and making them laugh, I prefer the question and answer so much more than any kind of stilted dialogue, any kind of stilted delivery, like at a book reading or I hate that word lecture for a book event because that just means a bunch of people sitting around with their butts going numb. Playing off those questions is my favorite part of the event. And I've just never have been nervous in front of a crowd of people. I know we're supposed to be. I heard once that was like one of the greatest fears, like right up there with death and snakes and spiders. Well, I think that might be complete and utter horse crap. I'm really afraid of snakes, and I'm sure afraid of dying. I ain't at all afraid of standing in front of a bunch of people and talking about books. I was the Calhoun County, Alabama public speaking champion for the 4-H Club in 1973, I think, or four. And so now standing in front of a group of people has never scared me a little. Of course, I've never been in a witness stand, so, you know.
Right, so it might be a little different if there are legal ramifications.
Right.
All right.
Right.
I was marginally aware of you, and I had read one of your books prior to hearing you. And then after that, I was like, oh, man, that led to me reading all of your books. So nicely done. Not the kind of thing that I've seen from a lot of other writers who I think sometimes go into those things with a prepared speech. Whatever the audience gives them, they're going to say the same thing. And you didn't do that. That was nice. That made it fun to watch.
Well, thank you. Well, that's what I mean about the Q&A is so much more interesting. And sometimes at those things, especially if you look out in the audience and you know that you got fans there that have heard you before, you sure don't want to give them the same, you know, diet of lecture. So, you know, I'd rather talk with them than talk at them. Talking at them bores me to tears.
Yeah, it's like, I've already done this. Let's do something new.
Right.
Let's make this special for you.
Exactly. A very smart man that I worked with, a newspaper editor years ago, told me, he said, don't be dismayed on book tour if what you were saying to the audience begins to sound a little phony over time. And what he meant was that not that you would that you were being disingenuous, but that once you say the same thing 40 nights in a row, it's going to sound rehearsed.
Right, after like the 100th time.
Exactly. So I found that answering those questions, not necessarily from the pages of the book, but from your experiences in writing it, and telling stories with color and image and detail, which is the way you should write, but you can talk that way too. I don't ever want to sound like I actually think I know what I'm doing, because I think that's the beginning of the end. If you can have people walk away and say, I have an extra page now, or two or three extra pages that didn't make it, that wound up on the cutting room floor. Like in the Jerry Lee Lewis book, there was a song that he sang about his mother, and I could not get the editor, who was a fantastic editor, Calvert Morgan at HarperCollins, just for some reason would not allow this song into the book, and it's a song called Charming Billy. And in it, Jerry Lee Lewis turns it into a love song for his mom. And it's the lyrics are, in Jerry Lee's version, can you really rock and roll, Billy boy, can you really rock and roll, Charming Billy? Yes, I can really rock and roll. I can even do the stroll. But I'm a young cat, and I can't leave my mother. And to me, that was just, that was just achingly Jerry Lee.
Yeah, and it seems like that's something that you would connect to with your own connection to your mom.
Hey, absolutely. But for some reason, I couldn't get Cal to let me put that in the book. What I do is at every chance I get, in every venue, I talk about that song.
You find a way to sneak it in spite of the editor.
Yeah.
The writer gets the last laugh, right?
Exactly. But you know what's funny is that people seem to really like it. They seem to really like the emotion in it. You don't want them to walk away feeling like they've heard a historian lecture on his 13th volume on the Crimean War.
Yeah. One can only hear so much about the Crimean War.
Exactly. The sad truth is I probably wouldn't mind a good lecture on the Crimean War. I'm not sure that I'm qualified to deliver too many historical lectures, although I try to put as much history in my books as I can. I'm just kind of popular history, but, in the books on family, I try to put as much history of immigration and as much history of Native Americans as I needed to build a foundation for where my people came from.
Yeah, you get a sense of that, of someone grounded in the history of the place.
I hope so. I hope so. And how do you get it? Well, you read it, you know, from people who are better at it than you are. I read a great number of historians. One of the best in the Deep South is a man named Wayne Flint, who is a great historian and writer about the poor whites of the foothills of the Appalachians. And nobody's better at that than him. So I tell him over and over again that, I hold 5-gallon buckets of his work in my work. I just devour what he writes about my people.
I was wondering if we could talk a little bit about your journalism experience and then come back to some of the things you've written in your books.
Sure.
All right. Well, the way that a story is reported can have a big impact on someone's life, but even on the community. What would you say the responsibility is of a journalist to his subjects when he's telling the story?
Well, I know this will sound cliche, but I didn't do a lot of investigative journalism. So my job was rarely to catch the people doing wrong. My job was most often on the important stories, was most often in writing about victims and writing about people who had found themselves, ordinary people had been thrust into an impossible situation, bombings and storms and political genocide. And there's an old journalism cliche, putting a human face on tragedy. And it is a cliche, but it's probably the truest one. If you can do that, if you can put a human face on the Oklahoma City bombing, if you can put a human face on a trailer park in Louisiana where women are suffering miscarriages because of the possible contamination in the water, if you can put a human face on a storm, a tornado, you can put a human face on slaughter and hate, then I think that maybe that's the best you can do. It's certainly the best I've ever done. That's the best I've ever done, was to try to put a human face on it, to put flesh and blood on the issue, to put flesh and blood and cost, the human cost of an event. no one, I believe, has their heart really break over a statistic. I mean, if you tell me that parts of my state, Alabama, have a higher infant mortality rate than sections of Africa, then...
it's hard to connect to that.
Yeah, that breaks my heart. But if you can show the issue as a great series of stories in a paper called the Montgomery Journal did years and years ago at the beginning of my journalism career. I was working for one of the rival papers for him, and they did a great series on infant mortality. If you can, for instance, in the Oklahoma City bombing, if you can put a face on the victims, then that's the best thing that you can do. And of course, that's a minefield, because is it exploited to go and delay these people there, you know, for a headline or for a front page story? It's complicated. And the truth is, maybe once I understood my own craft well enough to answer that, I think it's a little bit of both. If you can make a life matter by moving it beyond the statistic, the cold statistic, then I think maybe you've done what you're supposed to. I hope that makes sense.
Oh, yeah, it does. This might sound kind of out there. Are you familiar with the Prime Directive from Star Trek?
I am, as a matter of fact.
All right. So the Prime Directive is basically the idea that Starfleet doesn't interfere with the cultures that they encounter.
Right.
And you could tie that to some journalists who have the idea that they should be impartial entirely in their reporting, just the facts kind of thing. And then there's another school of thought that says, well, it could be a force for good, a way to advocate for a certain kind of change. Do you fall one way or another in that dilemma?
You know, it's funny. Sometimes it seems like Star Trek metaphors are about the only way I understand anything.
That's right.
But I do think that only a handful of times in my writing life have I felt like I did harm. You know, where through clumsiness, maybe, I stomped all over the Prime Directive. Like, for instance, through clumsiness, you allow someone to say something in a story because they are not sophisticated as to the medium, and they say something that results in them losing a child.
Oh, no. So even though it's the truth, maybe that
right.
quote shouldn't have been included because the person didn't understand the context?
Yeah, they didn't understand the consequences. Sometimes people, you know, just don't understand how naked they will be in print, you know. I did a piece on, they were called memorial walls in Manhattan. Not in Manhattan, but in part of Manhattan, but mostly in the Bronx and and in Brooklyn. When there is a death by violence, the young people will decorate the scene of that death with graffiti, sometimes elaborate artwork and murals, and sometimes just a name, you know, and, you know, scrawl there with felt-tip pen. So I interviewed a young woman whose brother had been shot to death, and you know, she described to me in great detail the crime, described the assailant, described what he said as he fired, you know, bullet after bullet into this young man. And she spoke with me in, you know, understanding that I was a reporter, understanding that I was writing a story about it. But when she saw it in the pages of the newspaper, there was an awfulness to that, you know, that broke her heart. It's a minefield, I think.
Well, on the other side of that, I heard you talking about how you believe that a story that you wrote on Haiti might have led to some military involvement there. So that might be an instance where it had a more positive impact, something that you wrote.
Yeah, there are all kinds of good result from a good story. Friends of mine ribbed me for a very long time, you know, that I was kind of the angel of death in a lot of ways, because, you know, I showed up only when things were at their worst. I showed up only after a bomb had gone off, or after a government had been kicked out, like in Haiti, or, you know, that's what I did, mostly in this country. And but you can occasionally have a direct impact. Like I wrote a story about a little boy in Fort Lauderdale who had been accused of a sex crime. He was only, he was just a, preschool kid. And
wow, no kidding.
A little girl had been assaulted, and she'd been assaulted by a man who was living with her mother. And the man told her to say that it was this little boy who did it. The boy was arrested and carried in and photographed and fingerprinted. And then when word came out that the little boy was innocent, the sheriff's deputies in Broward County just dumped him back off on the street corner and never bothered to explain to the housing project, to the community, that he was innocent. So the myth, the lie, continued, and the little boy was ostracized and slapped and kicked and even beat.
Oh, man, that's terrible.
And his mama, I called her up. I'd seen a short story in the Miami Herald, or Associated Press, I can't remember. And I called his mom, and she said she agreed to talk to me. And I went out and wrote a long, heartbreaking story about this. And it probably did some good, because his mama took a big handful of them and taped them on the walls and passed them out and directly affected the way that the community around her son reacted to him. And, he got some psychological help. He became a ball boy, I think, for the Miami Heat basketball team. And,
oh, wow.
Now, I don't know. As a matter of fact, I heard that, that was a temporary reprieve. And that I did not keep up with him because that story, faded into hundreds of others.
But at least for that time, you helped change the minds.
Yeah, for that very slim, very narrow sliver of time, you have an effect. And in Haiti, you write about the killing and you try to again, put a human face on it. And maybe that story, with all the other dozens and dozens and dozens of stories through other outlets, maybe they pile up and become part of an impetus for something like the walk-in invasion of Haiti. If you feature a family that's lost everything from a storm, money will find its way to them. Sometimes people use the stories, these very human stories, as a way to reach people that they need to get a hold of, like people in a story I did about babies who had been sold by a country doctor in North Georgia. It helped them connect, or at least that's what they were hoping for. So, every now and then you stumble around and you do something decent, with your work. Being a reporter for a long time does leave you with a whole lot of cynicism, but it also, if you look at it realistically, every now and then, like I said, you stumble around and almost accidentally, it seems, sometimes you do something good. More than anything, though, I think if you can touch the hearts of the reader, then you're winning.
We're talking about the power of story, and this seems like a good opportunity to take a break from the interview and hear from our sponsor, LA Film Prize. Gregory Kallenberg is in a position to observe all kinds of filmmakers. I asked him for some suggestions that filmmakers could do to increase their chances of success, either at his festival or festivals in general. Here's what he had to say.
I think the easiest way to answer that question is to give the two rules if you want to win the $50,000. If you want to win the $50,000 in cash, good story and good sound always wins the day. And I think the biggest challenge and the biggest problem we see with filmmakers who are overly ambitious or the ones that don't quite know how to put the handle on the work itself, if you can just focus on good story and good sound, you're going to get a lot farther down the road than you'd ever thought you'd get.
Good advice from Gregory about the power of story. It's worth taking that extra time to get the story right. Whether you're a seasoned filmmaker or you're just getting started, I would encourage you to seriously consider submitting to the LA Film Prize. Now, I can't guarantee that you're going to win the $50,000 in cash. It's a very competitive festival. Here's the thing, though. This is the opportunity you've been waiting for to put together a project that means something to you while working with talented people, professionals even. Look, professionals are pretty busy. They might not have time to do your particular side project, especially if you can't meet their asking price. But if you say, this could be seen by thousands of people at the LA Film Prize Festival, and if we work really hard at it, we might have a shot at winning that cash. And we're going to have a short film that we're really proud of making when it's all said and done. All kinds of creative people will jump at that opportunity. The LA Film Prize was the spark that brought about Trench War, a short film I directed, and one that I'm quite proud of putting together. It can happen for you too. The only stipulation is that your short film has to be shot in the Shreveport-Bossier area, northwest Louisiana. What are you waiting for? Get your concept together, get your team together, and get started. Visit lafilmprize.com to learn more. And remember, if you stick around to the end of the show, you might just get a special discount code for 50% off registration. All right, now let's get back to hearing master storyteller Rick Bragg talk about the stories in his world. Have you had people respond more to your journalism or to the books that you've written?
Well, that's a really hard question because the two careers blurred together in the 1990s. I didn't do a book until I was in my 30s. Before then, it was, you know, any attention that I got from my writing was in journalism. And I was lucky that I worked for some places that reached a lot of people. You know, I worked for the biggest paper in my state at the Birmingham News, and then went from there to the St. Petersburg Times, which, you know, is one of the great American newspapers. And so they had a pretty good reach long before I ever went to the New York Times. But I do think, you know, the books, even though obviously, it's easier to get your hand on a newspaper than it is on a hardbound book. But the books have reached so many people. I have to say the books now.
Yeah, well, I will say for me, the books have had a big impact. I mean, I do appreciate your journalism, and it gives a look at America in lots of interesting ways, or the world at large. But I really connected to the personal aspects of your books and your attempts to come to terms with your father and your difficult upbringing. So let's talk a little bit about those. It seems like one of the recurring interests in the books is whether someone can rise above their circumstances and become something better. Would you agree with that? Is that something that is relevant to you?
I hope so, yeah. I think the word better is a little complicated because, you know, I don't know a better human being than my mom, you know, who never had a chance to do anything beyond the corner of the county where I grew up. But I would consider her very successful because she survived. But the funny thing that happened with All Over But the Shouting and Avis Man and Prince of Frogtown was how people responded, how almost visceral it was. It was as though I stole their story from them. And they would even say that. They would come up to the book signings and say, it'd be an old man or an old woman, and they'd say, son, you stole my story. And sometimes it would be a 20-year-old who would come up and say, always wanted to write my story, and now I know how, which always made me feel good somehow. But what they're saying is that, you know, it's a big club of us out there, to a big, big club, a society of people who, you know, their beginnings, their upbringings were not perfect. And somebody had to rise up as a champion in that world and in that life and save them, as my mother did. And sometimes the only person who can rise up and save you is yourself. And I hear a lot of those stories. And all of those stories are worth the book. Probably will never happen, but they're worth the book. So, you know, when I heard that at first, it kind of made me feel bad. I thought, oh, God, there are others. There are so many others out there. But in time, I began to realize that, no, this is what they're saying is welcome to the family.
Yeah, and you know, the way that I see the progression, and again, this might just be me, but it seems like it's an interesting way of coming to terms with your father, and I see that in all the different books. In All Over But the Shouting, you have a sense that when you're writing it, you're still angry and hurt by some of the things that your dad did. But it seems like as the books progress, you get more of a complex view of who he was. Did writing help you come to terms with the past?
It did. People always ask me if I forgive him now. And they almost bark my answer sometimes. And I said, well, no, hell no. Hell no, I don't. But, you know, you're right. But after All Over But the Shouting came out, that was my very quick response. It's more complicated now. Do I forgive him? No, not until he rises up out of the grave and makes everything right with my mother. You know, gives her back her youth and her future that he took. No, I don't really forgive him. But now when I think about my father, there is so much more. There is so much more to him than just the town drunk. Now when I think about my father, there is a more complete man. You know, we did Prince of Frogtown for one reason only. I felt like I had done a one-dimensional job of bringing him to life and all of the challenge. So I went searching for five people. I thought if I could just find five people who would tell me one good story about my father, then from that I could tell his story and have a more complete biographical series on my people. But more than that, too, is I'm a boy, and a boy wants to know more about their father than brutal amount that I knew. And so I went looking for those people, and I found them. And I found people that loved him, and people who considered that he saved their life. That I found them, and it made it a pretty good book. So yeah, I no longer can bark my answer. You know, it's a little more complicated now. But no, you know, we're kind of haters. You know, my people are. It's pretty obvious. I mean, we're haters. You know, we have never forgiven anybody any damn thing. And I wish it wasn't that way, but it's probably the truth. But now, you know, there is so much more to him than the town drunk.
You mentioned in All Over But the Shouting that his experiences, your dad's experiences in Korea, quite possibly affected him for the worse. And so it occurred to me when I was reading your book on Jessica Lynch that you were maybe interested if someone who has faced traumatic experiences, even in war, in the context of war, if they can survive that and still be a decent human being.
Yeah.
And so I was wondering, was that something that you thought about when you heard her experiences, her ways of dealing with trauma, and how it contrasted with your dad's?
Absolutely, and it gave me a better understanding. You know, we did the Jesse Lynch story before I did Prince of Hogtown, and definitely so. The trauma that Jesse went through was of a kind that just eclipsed anything my father went. You know, it was a meanness and a cruelty and a trauma that my father suffered, you know, a dot, a fraction. But it did help, yeah. You know, it's funny. When you're a young man, you hear all your life, you'll understand it later by and by. You know, they always put a biblical twist on it. You know, you'll understand it better by and by, son. You know, I hear the old people say. But it is true. There is an ignorance in youth that, now don't get me wrong, I'm still pretty ignorant, but there is a profound ignorance in not having seen enough, not having done enough, not having felt enough, not having been disappointed enough, that makes everything pure and pat and perfect. And maybe it has to be that way. Maybe that's where ideology comes from, but I was a better writer in my father in Prince of Frogtown, if only for the decade that had slipped past between the first book and this book.
Yeah, you had some time to reflect on and come to terms with some of the past.
Absolutely, absolutely. And, you know, and also just perspective. Yeah, perspective is so valuable. I guess about the time I get to where I'm reasonably intelligent and am, like, qualified to write a book, I probably will no longer be able to find the keys to tap it out.
Oh, you mean by the time you get there, you'll be in old age?
Yeah, I won't be able to see the keyboard anymore. I'll be too, you know, or I won't be able to find them. I probably won't even be able to spell at that point. But I'm not getting any younger.
Well, I think you're coming down a little hard on yourself. I mean, you know, you did win the Pulitzer and all those other recognitions.
Well, I was grateful for those. But it's been an interesting gig. I mean, I'm honored to have gotten to write for a living. And that's not just something that you say because you're supposed to. I'm honored to have written for a living.
Yeah, and the way you describe it in Oliver But the Shouting, it's either a set of happy accidents that you say or the providential moving of things that made it possible for you.
Right.
I was going to say, do you ever think and wonder how it could have gone otherwise?
Oh, sure. I mean, you know, there were half dozen times in my young life where there were other things I wanted to do and other places I wanted to be. I wanted to be an architect at one point, and I actually took drafting because I love the idea of creating a building, an edifice, on paper, and then see it take shape in a skyline. There's just something about that that was just beautiful to me. But I couldn't do the math. You know, I got my first job in journalism because the man they offered it, he was a young man. We were both going to school at Jacksonville State University. It was my first and only year there. But the local paper, the local weekly paper, had a job opening for a sports writer, and they offered it to this young man, Jerry Rutledge, and he turned it down because he had a good, steady job at the Kentucky Fried Chicken. And the Kentucky Fried Chicken job paid better than the journalism job, quite frankly, probably still does. So he turned them down, and I got the job. I was second choice. So my journalism career began because the first choice turned it down.
Someone had an affinity for making chicken.
Yeah, exactly, right. You know, and of course, he did ultimately become a journalist and quite a good one. But so that luck has played a tremendous, tremendous part. One of the best small newspapers in the country, easily considered one of the best small newspapers in the country, is called the Anniston Star. In Anniston, Alabama, which just happened to be the county seat of the county where I was born and grew up. And so, again, what's the chance of that, that you would go to a small newspaper that would hire you without a college degree? And what are the chances that you know, it would be there, right there, geographically? So, yeah, I've had a lot of luck.
Yeah, and you mentioned that your teachers, some of them didn't think that you would amount to very much, and you had your one of your brothers who did some jail time, and so not everyone thought it was a sure thing that you would become a writer, let's say.
My English comp teacher actually kicked me out of the class because she said I wasn't mature enough to take English composition. I almost didn't graduate because apparently I had an entire year of unexcused absences in homeroom.
Wow, that takes some doing. You've got to work at that.
Well, I didn't see any point in homeroom because, well, what do you do in homeroom? Nothing. You know, I didn't even know they took a roll. I mean, I didn't go enough. It happened to be the first class, so that gave me 30 to 45 minutes of sleep. And I just didn't figure I was missed. It turns out I was. But the principal was a very kind man, allowed me to graduate anyway. What a disaster that was. I could have been a high school dropout. I think it might be a little bit of an exaggeration to say that I clawed my way out of poverty to make it in this craft. Because, yes, I mean, the poverty was genuine. My mother stood in line with a baby on her hip for commodity cheese and peanuts. She really did drag me on a cotton sack across a million miles of cotton field. She really did take in laundry and ironing so that I would be talking to you today. She really did raise other people's children and scrub their floors. So she crawled and she fought for our survival. And the storytelling ability that I inherited from my people, from my uncles, from my cousin, from my mother, that was almost the easy part of it. You know, my little brother, you know, was not so fortunate and did do some prison time. My older brother, Sam, has worked every weekday of his life with his hands, you know, slinging wrenches and, you know, cutting timber and working in a cotton mill, driving dump trucks. I mean, you know, and he was not as lucky as me. So I was lucky.
Let's go back to Prince of Dogtown, because there is a sense of the circle of things and whether that pattern can be unbroken at some point. It seems like you suggest at how your life changed a little bit and you were able to become a dad to your stepson. And yet there's also that part where you talk about how you don't see how things could have changed for your dad. Do you still feel that way? Do you still feel like regardless of what happened, there was no way that things would have changed for him?
I think my father had a demon that I was spared. You know, my father, you know, was an alcoholic. He wasn't the kind of alcoholic he was not a functional alcoholic. You know, you see a lot of those, you know, who can hold a job, you know, can argue a case in court, can teach a class, can do a lot of things and still be a drunk. But my father was not a functional alcoholic. My father was a drink until you forget all things. Drink until your finer nature vanishes down the neck of the bottle, you know. So my father truly never had a prayer because he simply could not be that predisposition. And it was a predisposition. He came from drunks, and he just didn't have a chance. I always thought that was a weakness because I thought surely a man, you know, a grown, strong man should be able to conquer something as tiny as a bottle. But, you know, I never had it. I never had the thirst the way that he did. So it's, yeah, we're very different. Others in my family, young and old, were doomed as well.
So alcohol is not an issue for you?
I don't drink because I do like it. I mean, I really like it. It gives me a peace of mind. When I drink, it gives me this incredible peace of mind. Everything's going to be all right when you're drunk, but I can't get anything done. So I don't drink.
So you've stayed away from it?
Yeah, I just don't. Yeah, I drink about, I haven't had a drink in, I don't know, years.
Well, that's impressive.
And before that, I hadn't had one for years. I said once I generally used to pitch a good drunk about once every 2 years, but now it's not even that. I just don't want it, don't need it. And besides that, I have too much to do.
Yeah. I go back and forth on that myself. It is an area that can be a problem for many, certainly. It was interesting. I was reading Neil Young's biography, Waging Heavy Peace, and he talks about how he is trying to go sober. And then he mentions that all of his great music was written under the influence. And yet he's trying to write. So there is that dilemma of whether it aids or detracts from the creative work. But you've managed to do without for several years, and you've been writing for several years. So there you are.
I think it's to me, one, and I realize this will cause a lot of people to get all up in arms, but it, to me, one of the least interesting American writers was Hunter Thompson. Now, not least interesting in what came out on the page, but just, I'm just not really interested in getting really messed up and doing something creative. You know, to me, I can't do it. I can't write drunk, which I guess makes me not a genius. But I just can't do it.
No, it's actually encouraging to hear.
Which makes me a very bad Southern writer.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of Southern writers like Faulkner and, you know, Hemingway, I guess, and they have that association with alcohol, but it's not something that is necessarily a good thing, and people can certainly create without it. So way to be a good example of how to do otherwise.
I just can't think clearly. And maybe, you know, that's the reason Faulkner never could find a place to put the comma. You know,
if only he hadn't been drinking, his sentences would have been grammatically correct with the commas. All right.
All right, exactly. So I don't know. I think it's a craft. There is also the organization of the work that I find I have to be clear-headed to do. And I don't believe in the muse. I don't believe that you write when you feel inspiration. My muse has always been something coarser, like worry or want or need. Sometimes my muse has been a deadline. Sometimes my muse has been a contract. And I don't know. I think it's an... to me, it's craft, and so I treat it like one. I wouldn't go into a machine shop and try to mill a gear and expect that gear to spin and run and mesh smoothly. And I think it's the same way with writing. That'll get me kicked out of the fancy writers club, but
the Faulkner Society of America or whatnot.
Yeah, right. never have belonged to the Faulkner Society.
Well, you know, speaking of alcohol, in Prince of Dogtown, there's a passage that's one of my favorites in all of your books. It's when you describe the two ditches that people go down. There's either the ditch of alcohol or the ditch of religion, of faith. Mm-hmm. And I've got to tell you, on some days I've been waddling both of those ditches, sometimes even within the same few hours. So that was interesting, but I do like the way that you treat faith throughout your work. You have that sense of it, of acknowledging its excesses at times, but also the dignity and hope that it can bring to some people. I had a chance to look at your introduction to The Wooden Church as a Celebration, and you have that aspect of it even there. Well, there's a quote where you say, because if there is no faith, there is just everything else, just living, and living can be so damn hard. So it's a more nuanced way of approaching faith than other writers I've seen. So I was wondering if you'd care to comment on that.
Well, you know, like most people, I think I'm always a little suspicious of people who say that they've got it all hammered out as far as faith goes. Because I'm still mildly confused by it. But the one thing that I'm absolutely convinced of is that, well, that line that you just talked about. I very much want there to be a heaven because I want my mother to have something easier than she had on this planet.
Something that would justify all the suffering.
Exactly. And that she has lived a life. And she has lived a life that should, under any reasonable expectation of the faith that she clings to, that should deliver her into heaven. And I very much want there to be heaven. I am not optimistic of my place in it, but I very much want there to be one. You know, the one thing I kind of like to get through this life without being is a hypocrite. It seems like, especially in the modern day South, that we operate on a system that allows you to be a good man at the pulpit and then a bad man in the voting booth. You can claim to be devout, claim to be a man of charity and compassion, and yet go vote against whether or not the lady who wipes the tables at Waffle House can have health insurance. Well, it's complicated and confusing, isn't it?
It is, yeah.
The one thing I'm sure of is that for a lot of people, life is hard, and there needs to be something at the end of it. There needs to be some reward. Because if there's not, it's the sad to be unspeak.
That's very profound. I wanted to just take a moment to process that. You know, let's go back to Prince of Dogtown. Did you realize when you were writing Jerry Lee Lewis that you compared your dad to Jerry Lee Lewis in Prince of Dogtown? Was that something you were thinking of?
Probably that was just subconscious. It, you know, bled over into the other one, I'm pretty sure. Yeah, but there were many, there were phrases that fit both men perfectly, you know, and images of both men. So no, it wouldn't surprise me if that happened.
Yeah, I mean, he was also a hard-living, hard-drinking kind of guy. I mean, there are several similarities. And in fact, one of the things that was kind of neat was that it was almost like reading your books on your family and the working class background from which they came helped give context to Jerry Lee's music. But then I think you could also say that some of Jerry Lee Lewis's songs give context to your dad, right?
Oh, absolutely. Oh, yeah. I think so.
I mean, there were a couple of them in particular, like What Made Milwaukee Famous has made a loser.
It made a fool out of me, yeah.
I thought a little bit about the way you described your dad with that, and Working Man Blues, and She Still Comes Around.
Oh, yeah.
You know, even, even that Jerry Lee Lewis song, Would You Take Another Chance on Me?
Right.
I was thinking about that song in context of your dad when he was at Dallas with your mom. And, you know, I was actually pulling for him at that point in The Prince of Dogtown. Yeah. I know he did all those horrible things, but at that point you had showed his likable side, or at least that he was human, that he had some good qualities at one point. So it was kind of sad that it didn't work, that second chance that he had just didn't come together, that your mom left and that he fell back to where he was. But it was striking that your work helps to clarify Jerry Lee Lewis and vice versa.
Jerry Lee's music was an anthem for my people in a lot of ways. There's just no way around that. I'm not surprised that they would kind of run together, you know, like mud and water, you know.
Uh-huh.
Not surprised that they'd kind of run together.
I really liked Jerry Lee Lewis. Again, you brought faith back into it as that central question, it seems, that he kept wondering throughout his life, can a good man play rock and roll? And that was fascinating. I had not been exposed to that aspect of him. And you even had those two quotes, that epigraph at the beginning where you quote the verse from Hosea and then the Tom Waits quote. So, yeah, I mean, a very conflicted character, but someone who seemed to have a sense of faith, or he wrestled with it throughout his life. Would you agree with that?
Oh, sure. And he wrestles with it in some ways today. Jerry Lee fully understands that there is a hell, and he fully believes in that hell, and he does not want to go there, and he wants very much to join his people in the New Jerusalem. But the reason that Tom Waits quote is in there is because if Jerry Lee had exercised his demons, then you know, what would we have had? Would we have had the best piano playing gospel music recording artist of all time? Yes, but that's what we would have had, and not the cultural phenomenon. Certainly not the icon that is Jerry Lee Lewis, and we would not have, you know, much of his great music. We just would not have.
It's almost like that's a more honest religious outlook anyway, that people are sometimes prone to look to the heavens, but also to sometimes end up in ditches. And it's almost like it's a disservice to suggest otherwise when people try to do it the other. I mean, you have the contrast with James Swaggart in there, who was related to him, and he was more the guy who tried to be entirely religious throughout his life, and he had his struggle. So yeah, it's just something that is really captivating.
I hope so. I hope people respond to the book that way. But, you know, they're just getting much dull in Jerry Lee Lewis's life. You know, nothing dull in it. But I'm going to have to wrap up on you. I've got to do some other things, but I cannot remember when I've had a longer or better conversation about the contents of my work. I mean it. I have greatly enjoyed this.
Well, thank you so much. I really appreciate you taking the time to stay and chat.
I mean it. I have really enjoyed it, and And let's pick it up again sometime when we don't have to work. We'll just yak a little bit. How about that?
Sure, sure. Before you go, could I ask one more question? This is the last question I ask my guests. It's a fairly quick one. Let's say your ideal collaborator is listening to this. What would you want him or her to know about getting the best out of Rick Bragg?
Oh, I don't know. It's you know, that's really hard to answer.
I know. I saved the hard one till the very end.
Right. I guess if you're going to get the best out of me at this point in my life, at 55, leave me the hell alone. You know, I think the editor on this book got a much better book because he did not follow that advice. He pushed and prodded and demanded more and insisted on more. So he got a much better book.
So even though you say people should leave you alone, sometimes it's good if they don't always listen. Okay.
Yeah, sometimes it's better. I want them to leave me alone, but maybe it's better that they don't. I need a handler.
All right. Well, it's a heck of a book. I really enjoyed it. Thanks again for chatting with us.
Oh, listen, it was my pleasure. We'll do it again.
All right. Take care, Rick. Bye now.
Bye-bye.
Okay. So that's our interview with Rick Bragg. And what an interview. I was really taken by his humility and his contemplative answers. This is a guy who's won the most prestigious award for his field. And he's still talking about how he is just now starting to learn how to tell a story, to just now get at the truth of something. It didn't strike me as false modesty. I think it's just a part of how he sees the world, of realizing how complex it can be to really get to the heart of the matter. And he was even willing to acknowledge in some instances where he might have hurt a situation. Again, in contrast with someone young and brash who would be talking all about his or her achievements. So quite striking, quite humbling to hear that from someone like Mr. Bragg. You know, it's almost like finding a certain level of success allows for more honesty. In my experience, the people who seem to be the most full of themselves, sometimes I encounter these people at certain industry events, for example, film events, people telling me about all of their accomplishments. It seems a lot of times those people are the ones who feel the most insecure, who feel like they have to work harder to prove their worth. When people get to a point of success where it's widely recognized, they can then perhaps be more reflective and say, well, here are some things I do well. Here are some things I'm trying to do better. In any case, it is refreshing to hear someone like Rick Bragg talk about the things that he's still trying to improve upon. Didn't it make you feel a little better when you heard him say that? I felt a little better. It's a hopeful thing. Like, hey, most of us don't have it all figured out, but we're working at it. And look, some people can make pretty impressive progress along the way. That's a nice effect to have on others. It's a considerate thing to do, right? But let's say you're not considerate. Let's say you're an entirely selfish person, all right? Here's the thing. A lot of us make assumptions about people based on similarities to others. What do other successful people do? They are willing and able to acknowledge shortcomings. They don't feel an excessive need to let people know about what they do because it's assumed, it's a given. What do unsuccessful people do? Those tend to be the ones who are more forceful in telling us about the things that they have done and the greatness that they embody because no one else is really saying it. Do you want others to have that impression of you? If not, doesn't hurt to try the considerate thing, even if it's for selfish reasons. Just a little public service announcement, folks. It's what we do here at the Insavides Podcast. It's about giving back and making the world a little better, one dinner party at a time. Okay, moving on. There was so much that I wanted to ask him about that we didn't get to. I had a couple of other topics, and even his comment about Hunter S. Thompson, it was
the kind of thing that I really wanted to ask him more about it, but then I was just nervous. Oh man, what if we don't actually get to the book? I think I know what he meant though about not being interested in the kinds of stories that Hunter S. Thompson tells. Those stories are very much about his experiences under the influence of drugs and alcohol. He's not looking out at the world like Rick Bragg likes to do. He's looking in a very small circle, very much about him. And it's an interesting point that he is impairing himself and maybe not able to see what's going on in the world because of that. I did find it encouraging that Rick Bragg has found creative success even without much influence from alcohol. And it's understandable considering his family's history, but it would be a challenge for me to name other notable Southern writers who aren't or weren't influenced by alcohol in a substantial way. Even Harper Lee, author of To Kill a Mockingbird and another one of Alabama's Pulitzer Prize-winning writers, is said to have been under the influence of alcohol on occasion, and that got in the way of one of the books that she was writing, at least if you believe Vulture.com, and who doesn't believe them these days? So anyway, it's nice that Rick can be that counterpoint. Alcohol is something that I wrestle with. I go back and forth on it. There's something to be said about being clear-headed, but I don't know, sometimes I get caught up in my head, and alcohol can help with that. Sometimes I buy into the idea that I'm more likable when I'm drinking or that I'm more creative. And a lot of that comes from insecurity. And it's a short-term fix, I would say. But sometimes it's a challenge to face some of the things in my life. Sometimes my parts of my life can be kind of out there as far as what happens. I think certain events would strain the believability factor if I were to tell you all of them. It's just how things tend to go in my world. And alcohol is one way to not think about those things or face them right then and there. Some of my Twitter followers might conclude that many of my tweets are in fact drunken tweets. And if only it were so, but that's not the case. The ones that are more out there tend to be ones that felt appropriate at the time when I was clear-headed. And sometimes it's like, you know, it's actually probably less likely that I will say something that's going to severely complicate my life in ways that I would prefer didn't happen when I am drinking. It's almost like that's the safer way to go. And sometimes I don't want to make things complicated. I don't want to listen to that voice that prompts me to do things. And alcohol is one way to muffle that side a little bit. So it is a challenge. But anyway, it's nice to hear that at least Rick Bragg can make it work without alcohol. So there you go. There's one. And I'm sure many, many others like him. You know, when I first saw Rick Bragg in person, it was at the Louisiana Book Festival. He was talking about his Jerry Lee Lewis book. And I was going to ask him why Jerry Lee, as opposed to anyone else. He's in a position where he can be very selective about the people he covers. Someone already asked that question right before they got to me, and I asked a different question. I'll tell you about that in a bit. But I think there's more to it than the answer he gave at the festival. His answer at the festival was that Jerry Lee Lewis was a native of Louisiana. He had a rich life, an iconic figure in rock and roll history, and a guy who lived an exciting life, and who wouldn't want to write about that? That's true enough, at least on the surface, but we all have things that influence our behavior that we might not even acknowledge, but that are still a very big part of why we do the things we do. In the case of Rick Bragg, I would say he saw in Jerry Lee Lewis a figure who was in many ways like his dad. In many ways, there were key differences. As I mentioned in the interview, in a book he wrote prior to Jerry Lee Lewis, The Prince of Frogtown, he actually specifically compares his dad to Jerry Lee. It was just a sentence in passing, but there's still that association. Let me read it to you. Writing of his dad, he says, he wore his wavy red-brown hair swooped up high like the killer Jerry Lee. While Rick Bragg's journalistic work is very much about what's happening in the world out there, his books are very much about coming to terms with his family and what made them the way they were, and even if there were ways that it might have gone otherwise. There's a sentence from one of Rick Bragg's pieces for the New York Times that clues us in on this. He ends one of the pieces with the sentence, quote, "No one has figured out a way to put the bullet back in the gun." You read his work and you get a sense that he's thinking about that. What if things had gone otherwise? Could things have worked out for this person or another? His own dad is asking those kinds of questions in The Prince of Frogtown. That's actually a Dickensian kind of preoccupation. Charles Dickens also was very interested in that sort of thing. Consider this quote from Charles Dickens. "I know that, but for the mercy of God, I might easily have been, for any care that was taken of me, a little robber or a little vagabond." That awareness of how things could go otherwise is seen throughout his stories. You see it in Oliver Twist, you see it in A Christmas Carol, in a very interesting way in A Tale of Two Cities. But this is not the podcast on Charles Dickens. I will say we are trying to book him as a guest for future episodes, but so far that hasn't come through. If you'd like this possibility and you specialize in making contact across the great beyond, please send me an email and we'll see what we can do. But in the meantime, let's tie it back to Rick Bragg's work. In other interviews, Rick Bragg has acknowledged an affinity for Charles Dickens. I submit to you that he sees in Jerry Lee another version of what his dad might have been, someone who was able to come to terms with his inner demons, to wrestle with alcohol, with his upbringing, and still find a sense of faith and higher purpose, much like Charles Dickens did with, say, Ebenezer Scrooge. That's not to say that Rick Bragg was thinking of or trying to draw comparisons to that kind of story. I'm just saying there are notable similarities to some of the preoccupations seen in Charles Dickens' work. And Rick Bragg, like Dickens, also has a rags-to-riches story. And again, someone who he has acknowledged in other interviews as an influence. In any case, Jerry Lee Lewis is the success story that Rick Bragg's father wasn't, or even some of the other characters you see in the stories that Rick Bragg tells. In his book, The Most They Ever Had, and in some of his other stories, you have these characters, these ghost-like characters who haunt the world. They seem to have this potential for music, that they could have been someone great, but something like the mill or alcohol or despair or their situation kept them down and prevented that potential from blossoming into something bigger, more lasting. Unlike those characters, unlike Rick's father, Jerry Lee Lewis finds a way through the stifling factors, whether through chance or the hand of providence, and becomes a sort of shining example on the hill, albeit a complex, conflicted example. And there's even a payoff at the very end where Rick gets something from Jerry Lee that he doesn't quite get from his dad. You will need to read a couple of the books to get that. At least All Over But the Shouting, The Prince of Frogtown, and the Jerry Lee Lewis book. I'm not going to tell you what he gets from Jerry Lee, because it's a nice moment, it's a nice payoff if you do take the time to read those books, but you get a sense that in a way, Rick is kind of sort of getting a relationship with a sort of father figure in Jerry Lee that he didn't quite get with his actual father. And his work, his writing, made that possible. I found that to be a touching, revealing moment, much like how Rick was describing his hope that there is an afterlife, if only to reward and make amends for all the suffering his mother has faced throughout the years. As I was suggesting during the interview, there are rich payoffs to reading the books together as a development, to see the way that Rick's thoughts toward his father change over time. They're all worth reading, but I'd recommend, somebody told me, that's the compilation of his newspaper stories for the New York Times. That's when he won the Pulitzer Prize, so you can see what A-level journalism looks like, and you learn a little bit more about the country and the world at large. And then for his books, All Over But the Shouting, that was his first attempt at writing about the family dynamics. And then it matures in The Prince of Frogtown. As we mentioned in the interview, before doing that, he did the book on Jessica Lynch, I'm a Soldier Too. I also recommend that one. It's almost as if being exposed to her and coming to understand the trauma she faced when she was captured in Iraq, that softens him a little bit toward his father, who is also a war veteran, his father having fought in Korea. And that softening allows him to write The Prince of Frogtown, where the dad is much more sympathetic. And then Jerry Lee Lewis, you have it come full circle, I would say. It's as if his father becomes the man he could have been, at least through Rick's literary efforts. If you are going to read just one book, I would say pick up the Jerry Lee Lewis book. It's a terrific book on rock and roll, one of the better ones I remember reading in recent history. What was really surprising to me was just how much the book was also a spiritual inquiry. Why is that surprising? Well, rock and roll has always had this association with the wild side, or the dark side, if you will. The legend goes that rock and roll started when Robert Johnson made a deal with the devil at the crossroads on a certain highway intersection. More people probably know the Charlie Daniels song, Devil Went Down to Georgia and He Was Looking for a Soul to Steal. Same sort of idea there. Even with musical predecessors to rock and roll, like the violinist Paganini, he was said to get his fiery intensity from a similar pact with the devil. So a recurring idea throughout. But there's also a spiritual side to rock and roll. Many of the early bluesy musicians who were playing at juke joints during the week were also playing gospel music on Sunday. And a number of rock and roll musicians had spiritual roots. Someone like Little Richard was once a preacher, for example. And some of them saw their music as a calling from God. Jerry Lee Lewis did, as mentioned in the book. In fact, one of his preoccupations throughout his life was wondering whether a man could play rock and roll music and still go to heaven and still be a good man. He would have these discussions even with someone like Elvis, who also wrestled with that, as told in Rick Bragg's book. It's interesting to me that our society is hesitant to widely acknowledge the spiritual side of rock and roll. There are certainly scholars who point to it, but the popular concept of it is not always presented that way. Maybe it's because we like to have the sense of something that is of faith, that it's pristine and pure, and that it's not conflicted and it's unambiguous in its goodness. I don't think that's how reality works. I think most of us are conflicted. We have good and bad sides of us, light and dark, and that there's something to be said for it being true for rock and roll as well. Maybe some of those songs are not necessarily inspired by the devil. Maybe there is some divine inspiration in there too somewhere. Who knows? Maybe it's what we need to realize that there can be vitality to life. We might forget it when we're stuck in a cubicle going over one mindless policy after another and trying to do whatever needs to be done or whatever it is. Maybe, just maybe, rock and roll or parts of it are gifts from the heavens to help us live more vibrant lives. Just because the goodness isn't immediately discernible doesn't mean there's no spirituality in it. And I think the same can be said for Rick Bragg's work. Sometimes he writes from the perspective of a skeptic who sees the wrongs, the hypocrisies that can come up from religion, but he also acknowledges the place, the meaning that it can have, and even on occasion allows for transcendence. Now, there was one thing that came up in our discussion about spirituality that I wanted to address. In our discussion, Rick mentioned that he didn't understand how some people can believe certain things on Sunday and then vote against expanded healthcare coverage during the week. I will tell you, I wrestled with whether to address this or not. I don't want this to become a political conversation. And healthcare can certainly be a polarizing topic, but it's also an important topic, and it's one that affects so many people's lives. If we want to make an impact, if we want to do things that are having a broad reach, it's a topic that does affect a lot of people. It's worth having those conversations at times. And the thing is, a lot of times I run into people who make assumptions that, well, the people who disagree with me are disagreeing because of questionable motives. Might be true in some cases. It's not true for me. I want healthcare to be more affordable. I want there to be lots of options. I want people to be able to get the coverage they need at a reasonable price. I want to see prices go down instead of up like they've gone for the past few years, the past few decades even. I just don't believe that the way that we're doing it is necessarily the right approach. Now, I'm not going to go into it and explain all my ideas about that. That would be a whole other side tangent, but I do want to highlight a book and a movie that address some of the challenges in the current healthcare approaches. The book is called Catastrophic Care by David Goldhill. It should be pointed out that he is a Democrat and also a business person. So it's not a partisan assault. It's a very thoughtful look at the problems we have, how we got into the situation we're in, and some of the systemic issues that make it worse that the current Affordable Care Act is not fixing. And then there's also the film, Wait Till It's Free. And this is a very well-made film that looks at the issues as well. And this one is told from the perspective of a family that had to face higher costs. The family profiled is not a rich family. You're seeing what they're facing, just trying to make ends meet. So those are both worthwhile if you want to explore this topic further, because sometimes it takes more than a compelling 5-minute video or 10-minute video, even if it's done by someone as articulate and savvy as John Green. Sometimes you need a little more than that to discuss what is at stake. And so if you're interested, I would encourage you to take a look. If for no other reason, you can understand the opposition to the Affordable Care Act, folks questioning the merit of expanded government bureaucracy in a personal part of our lives is not necessarily the same thing as being racist or not caring about poor people. Once again, another public service announcement from the Encevides podcast. At least take the time to understand the other side. I try to do that for those who disagree with me. I don't necessarily assume that you are a bad person just because you disagree. So, you know, I don't think it's asking a lot for you to do as much. I want to believe that a big part of this is just that certain ideas don't get as much coverage or airtime. And so this is my way of trying to address that in a small way and to aim for, to hope for, more civil discourse on a challenging topic. To be fair, I will mention this to Rick by email, and if he's so inclined, I will give him the opportunity to respond in the comment section. There was something else that I wanted to discuss with Rick, and we didn't have time for it either, and that is the 23 Enigma. The 23 Enigma is about how the number 23 and its inverse 32 and variations of 32 and 23 and the numbers that add up or multiply to make those numbers are recurring throughout history at notable moments. It sounds kind of out there, yes, but it's made popular by guys like Robert Anton Wilson and William S. Burroughs. William S. Burroughs, in particular, is a well-regarded writer of the Beat Generation and an influential postmodern writer. He's not exactly just crazy guy in basement with conspiracy theory. So, you know, some notable people find the recurring patterns of the number interesting. If you recall that barely watchable film, The Number 23 with Jim Carrey, the ideas in it were based on the 23 Enigma. All right, so why would I want to tell Rick Bragg about this out there, maybe crazy idea? Well, you know, wasn't planning on it, but I was going through his book. Somebody told me, I couldn't help notice the first three stories in it made reference to the number 23. The first story is one of Rick's classics where he looks at a tough situation and asks hard questions of faith without entirely discrediting the possibility that faith offers. That story begins the survivors chapter. It's the article entitled Tried by Deadly Tornado, An Anchor of Faith Holds. In it, a tornado hits a church and kills kids on Palm Sunday. In that story, the number 23 is the first number to appear after the dateline. In the next story, it's the last number that appears in the story, and then it appears again in the third story. In a later story, Unfathomable Crime, Unlikely Figure, two of the three criminals are 23 years old. Okay, so the number appears a couple of times in Rick Bragg's journalistic stories. So what? Maybe that's just me looking for the number, what people call confirmation bias. My podcast does come out on the 23rd after all. Maybe I'm just tuned to that number. All right, possibly, but that's not the only time it comes up in Rick Bragg's work. Rick Bragg's coverage of the Elian Gonzalez story is credited for helping him get that Pulitzer Prize. That first story appeared in April 23rd, 2000 in the New York Times. So not just any story, but one that was significant in his journalistic career. In Wooden Churches, the book where Rick Bragg writes the opening essay, there's a reference to Patrick Henry's speech, Give Me Liberty or Give Me Death. That happened on March 23rd. March 23rd was also the date of Jessica Lynch's abduction in Iraq. As it happens, her boyfriend at the time was, how old? 23. That's right. This podcast is also coming out March 23rd. Now, I didn't reorganize the schedule to make it work like that. In fact, I thought about making it come out earlier, but since this is when the podcast would have come out anyway, had I not altered the schedule, and since we've seen the number come up and I'm mentioning it here, it felt appropriate to just be consistent with what we've been doing in the past. What happened to Jessica Lynch in Iraq was tragic, but I'm encouraged by the way her hometown, her community responded. In Rick Bragg's version of the story, it's like the community comes together and tries to collectively fix the aches of that family. And through their contributions, through their volunteer hours, through their prayers, maybe, you get a sense that the family is still hurting that Jessica is still hurting as well, but that there might be some possibility for healing and growth. And again, it seems like she managed to face a very difficult ordeal and still emerge as a decent human being. And that is a hopeful thing to me. In context of Trench War, the short film I directed about a soldier battling post-traumatic stress disorder, I've been reading up about those who suffer from PTSD, whether from war or other traumatic events, and it doesn't always happen that way. So it is encouraging again that it seems like it happened for Jessica. Going back to the number 23, to those who are wondering, I didn't start off posting on the 23rd for my blog or for the show by choice. It happened that a couple of events just fell on that date, and it was interesting that it worked out that way. And so it made sense, but it started from the number appearing on its own, and then I made a choice to follow after it and not vice versa. You know, I want to give one example of how the number kind of follows me around sometimes in uncanny ways. Over the holidays, back in December, I was flying back home, and the number came up a couple times. It was I was at gate B23. The girl who was sitting beside me on the plane just turned 23. The flight, an hour and 32 minutes. I was reading in Empire magazine about Steven Spielberg, whose office at Universal Studios when he was starting out was 23C. The last number on the barcode for my magazine was 32. A children's book that my sister had gotten me had the number 23 in it. In the newspaper, I read that 23 detainees were transferred out of Gitmo. And there was also Air Asia Flight 8501 on newspaper as well, numerically very similar to Oceanic 815, which, as some of you may recall, is the flight that crashes in Lost. 815, 8 plus 15 is 23, as others have pointed out. So I think you'll agree that was at least a notable amount of the number 23 appearing. And I was actually writing about this in my journal. Here's the thing. We had been on a flight. We were flying out. The initial flight got delayed. We were waiting a few minutes on the plane itself when the pilot comes on and tells us, sorry about the delay, just doing some inspection of the brakes, and it seems like they need to be replaced. Which, just as a side note, when I'm on a plane, I don't really need the particulars of what is being done or the reason for the delay. A simple statement like, we are doing maintenance checks and we are now ready to go, thank you very much for your patience, would be fine. Anyway, our flight was delayed apparently because they were replacing the brakes. And then when we were in flight midway through, the pilot realizes the brakes we have on there are not sufficient to land on a shorter runway. And so we had to turn back and stay the night. So all this happened very unsettling. I was now more concerned about the number 23 appearing. I was writing about it in my journal, noting all these strange appearances of it. And then in my journal, when I got to that point when I was talking about how strange it is that the number kept coming up, on the page above, right where I was writing, was a verse. This is one of those journals that has different inspirational quotes and occasional biblical references. The verse on this one was Psalms 23, 3. And it said, true to your word, you let me catch my breath and send me in the right direction. So that was unsettling, to say the least. We managed to get back. The flight got rescheduled. We flew back and I made it back home okay. It did give me pause though. And while I will say I am ambivalent about alcohol, I still go back and forth on it. I am grateful that at least that pilot didn't come to work intoxicated. So thank you, sir, for that. Oh, yes. And the day that our flight got delayed, LSU was playing the Music City Bowl. Anyone care to guess what rank they were at the time? They were 23rd. Speaking of LSU and sports, the University of Alabama is a bitter rival of LSU. That's actually where Rick Bragg teaches. A few years ago, Rick Bragg did a profile piece for Sports Illustrated on Alabama coach Nick Saban, who many in Louisiana still haven't forgiven for leaving LSU. But the Nick Saban story was so popular in Alabama that many people in that state know him for that and not his books. There's also the number 23 in that story as well. Remember I said that the question I was going to ask Rick Bragg had already been asked at the Q&A? Since he was from Alabama speaking in Baton Rouge, I decided to ask him about the upcoming LSU-Alabama game. Bit of a curveball question, especially since he was in hostile territory for an Alabama fan. What can I say, ladies and gentlemen? We ask all the tough questions here at the Encevides podcast. But he handled it with aplomb and charm even, and it was his response there that won me over, that got me curious to read all his books and persist in trying to make this interview happen. I was actually wearing my LSU shirt under my semi-respectable clothes that I wore for the book festival. I wore that for good luck. It didn't really help. LSU lost, but I don't feel as bad about it because that game might have just been the determining factor that made this interview happen. The only other time I can kind of sort of overlook the indignity and the inhumanity of an Alabama victory over LSU is, as hard as it is for me to say, the 2012 BCS championship game where Alabama pummeled LSU. It took me a while to get to that point. I had actually moved to Baton Rouge that year, 2011, when LSU had their glorious 13-0 run, a victory streak that I interpreted as a friendly welcome to the state of Louisiana, which I thought was a very considerate gesture on behalf of LSU. But LSU's glorious season came to a disheartening end at the BCS game when the team couldn't score a single point, not even a field goal. That one hurt to watch, although that became more bearable a few days later when my New York Giants won the Super Bowl, and that was a victory I needed, possibly even a victory given to me and to the New York Giants, the representatives of all that is good on this earth. That's a whole other story. Anyway, it wasn't until I read an excerpt from the book Storm and the Tide by Lars Anderson that I could come to terms with the devastating LSU loss. You see, in the 2011 season, Appaloosa, Alabama had faced an awful tornado that killed several people, that devastated the town and the state even. It caused a crisis of faith in some, much like the tornado did in Rick Bragg's story in the New York Times. And the way that Lars Anderson tells the story in The Storm and the Tide, the BCS championship win was exactly what Alabama needed to find a rekindled sense of hope and possibility, much like the Saints Super Bowl win did for Louisiana when the state was in recovery mode from Katrina. Quite possibly, that 2012 BCS championship game happened as it needed to happen. In the Jerry Lee Lewis book, there's also a reference to an LSU-Alabama game. It comes at a time when there's a reflection of what might have been had certain circumstances not unfolded for Jerry Lee, how he might have been a very different person. And yet, somehow, things did work out. He did become the rock and roll legend that he has become. Sports journalism gave Rick Bragg his start as a writer, and an LSU-Alabama game gave me the impetus to ask the question that would spark my curiosity and lead to this interview. We've come full circle, so it's as good of a place as any to end. Who knows why some things happen the way they do? But just like with rock and roll music or anything really, maybe even a sports game can be a providential gift to those who need it most. All right, well, that's our show, ladies and gentlemen. A little longer than some other shows, but then there's lots to discuss about Rick Bragg's work. And we have some overlapping interests, I guess you could say. Rick's latest book, Jerry Lee Lewis, His Own Story. It's a fantastic read. Pick it up. I'll have a link for that and some of his other books in the show notes, as well as a few of the other articles that came up. If for some reason you want to hear more of my thoughts about the 23 Enigma, I can't imagine why, to be honest. It's a very strange affliction, but in case you do, or if you want to read perhaps the strangest, most unconventional James Dean story you will find, I will include a link to a blog post I wrote about James Dean, which is also very much about the number 23. So there's that as well, for those of you who are curious. All right, well, thoughts on the show, on Rick Bragg, on his work, on healthcare, on the number 23, on LSU or Alabama. We've talked about so many things. If you have thoughts on any of these things, you've got to have something. Come on, something. Write a comment on the page or shoot me an email, podcast@ncivitis.com, if you want to have a more personal, private conversation. Either way, let's keep the conversation going. All right, you made it to the end of the show to find out, will there be a 50% off discount for the LA Film Prize registration cost? The answer is no. Just kidding, no, there's a discount. The discount code you want to use is NCVDs1, that's NCVDs like the show, folks, and then the number one, NSAVIDES1. It's all lowercase. It is case sensitive. Again, lowercase, NCVDs1. Use that for 50% off your registration on LAFilmPrize.com. Music provided by Rob Coslow. The song, True Gemini. Thank you to Rick Bragg for coming on our little show here. Thank you so much for listening. Thank you to LA Film Prize for sponsoring this incredible episode. Viva La Film Prize. Until next time, let's make our future collaborations be better collaborations. That's right. Yeah, I'd like to do an interview. It's for a podcast. Yeah. So Mr. Dickens does not have a Skype account, but you know, can we figure something out? You know, send it through the ether or something? No? All right, well, that's something to research. Thank you. Thank you very much.